114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at the Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. Good morning, and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we will reach into the Focus 580 archives for a program from earlier this summer. So do keep in mind as you listen, we'll take your calls this morning. The show was first broadcast on June 8th. In this part of Focus 580, we will review the life of one of the most famous political operatives in U.S. history. Perhaps I should modify that and say maybe one of the most infamous, a man who set the standard for corruption in New York City more than a century ago. The man we're talking about is Boss Tweed. During his career, he, among other things, bribed the state legislature, fixed elections, and diverted public funds on a massive scale. In spite of his crimes, however, he was seen by a lot of people as a kind of a Robin Hood figure and remained a popular hero, at least with people of the working classes, until he died. This morning in this part of the show, we'll be talking with Kenneth Ackerman, who has written a new biography of the man. The book is entitled Boss Tweed, The Rise and Fall of the Corrupt Paul Who Conceived the Soul of Modern New York, and it's published by Carroll and Graff. Our guest is the author of some other books about the Gilded Age. He has also served for more than 25 years in various senior posts on Capitol Hill and in the executive branch, and currently he practices law in Washington, D.C. He is joining us by telephone. Mr. Ackerman, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So if we could take people back into time and we could meet Boss Tweed, what would be the first impression of this man? What would he have been like?
Oh, well, Boss Tweed was a very imposing figure. Physically, he was larger than life. He weighed about 300 pounds. He was over 6 foot tall. He walked with a swagger. He was actually in good physical shape. He had grown up on the streets of New York. He had led a street gang for a while. He had been the foreman of a volunteer fire squad. He was good in a fight. But he was also a very smart man. He dressed very well. By the time he became the political boss of New York, he was middle-aged, in his 40s. He liked to eat, and so he was overweight. He would dress very sharply. He would also impress you as a very outgoing, friendly man. He would probably not be shy at all about coming up to you, shaking your hand, slapping you on the shoulder, asking you some questions about your background, where you come from, what your parents did, what you do for a living, and how you vote, certainly.
It's interesting that I guess there's maybe not a whole lot of information available about his younger years, I mean, other than the kind of things that you talk about. It's his being involved as a volunteer fireman apparently using that and his natural abilities with people, mm-hmm. and his ambition to get involved in local politics and then kind of work his way up. So is there anything that can be said about him that would help to explain just what made him the person that he was?
Well, he was always smart in the sense that he was good with numbers. He went to school a couple of years. There's a stereotype of Boss Tweed as an illiterate drunk, and that's totally false. He grew up. His father had a chair making company. He was a chair maker on the Lower East Side of New York. His family wasn't wealthy, but they weren't poor. He went to the local school on Christie Street, and his father's scrimped money to send him to a boarding school for a year. He went into business and seemed to be good at it. But in addition to that, he had that certain political quality that you see in people who go into public life. If he would join a group, he would make a point soon to be the head of it. He didn't just join a street gang, he led it. When he joined the fire squad, soon he knew everyone in the group. He was the one who they voted. There was an election to choose the foreman, and he was the one who won. Once he entered politics through the Tammany Hall organization, he rose through the ranks. Around the time of the Civil War, he was elected the chairman of the General Committee, which was the operating committee of the group. Largely, as you said, there's not a lot of material about his early life. He's not someone who liked to give speeches. He wasn't a a theoretician. He didn't write long articles for the newspapers. That wasn't his style. But behind the scenes, he had a way with people. He had a sense of organization, of how to get things done in a very pragmatic way, so that when real-world problems came up, he was the person you'd go to.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe one great example of that, and one of the things that really helped establish him, were the draft riots in New York City, and the fact that he, unlike apparently a lot of other people who were in leadership positions who headed the other way, he dived right in.
Yeah. Tweed, I say he had grown up in the city of New York. He knew the people. The draft riots were a very ugly affair. They've been glamorized somewhat in the recent movie Gangs of New York, but there was nothing pretty about them. They came in 1863 at a time when the Union Army was not doing well, and the draft law itself, this was the first draft in American history, was very unpopular, particularly among the poor, because it had a provision saying that a wealthy man could spend $300 and buy his way out. So it was a very prejudicial law for the poor. When the riots broke out, they were primarily led by Irish immigrants, many drunken mobs. They were very racist. The mobs went after freed black people in New York in particular. There were several lynchings. The colored orphan asylum was burned to the ground. By the time it was over, most of the traditional politicians had run for cover. Either they wanted nothing to do with the draft, or else they wanted President Lincoln to declare martial law on the city. Boss Tweed was still brand new as the Tammany Hall leader. He had just been elected head of the General Committee a few weeks before the draft riots. He was one of the few people who kept his head about him in the crisis. He spent a lot of time on the street during the riots, and afterwards he was the one who negotiated a deal with Lincoln's War Department to have the draft go ahead in New York City, vouched for by Tammany Hall, but to use the city treasury to buy substitutes for anyone who didn't want to go. So essentially, Lincoln got his soldiers, but poor people in New York City got relief. And that established him, even among the wealthy elite, as someone who knew how to deal with the immigrant poor, how to keep the city calm in a crisis, and who knew how to manage a tough situation.
And that probably was what helped to establish his reputation with those people, with the poorer people, with the immigrants, as being somebody who was, you know, other people might have seen him as being a corrupt mm-hmm. Paul, which he was, and someone who enriched himself and his friends through his connections, and he was. But then for these other people, they were the ones who saw him as a kind of a hero who was, in some senses, looking out for their interest, and those may have been the only people who really mourned Boss Tweed when he died.
Well he lived in an era when corruption was rampant. During the Civil War itself, even the elite Republicans, the elite establishment people were profiteering like crazy from the war, selling defective meat or weapons or material to the War Department. Tweed's corruption early on was small change compared to the others. As he rose through the ranks, though, and became more powerful, he found he had a certain talent for embezzlement and money laundering and contract skimming and all of the accoutrements of corruption. By the time he was at his peak, he had organized it to the point where he and his circle stole more money from the city government than anyone else has stolen before or since.
That's pardon me for jumping in on you there, but I guess that's one of the things that I have seen various figures, and they're all sort of stunning when mm-hmm. you consider they would have been a stunning amount of money in those days, and in today's money, it's even a more stunning amount.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody have a good handle on just how much money?
Well, the numbers are all very, very vague and very political. By the time Tweed was brought down, everyone had an interest in exaggerating just how bad it was for their own selfish reasons. But the most careful count was done by an accountant named Henry Tainter, who worked for Samuel Tilden on the prosecutions. And he found that over the 3 to 4 year period when Tweed and his group were at their power, at their height of power, the total amount of graft taken altogether was about $45 million, which in modern money, generally you multiply by 20, would be about $1 billion altogether.
And that was just over a period of 3-4 years.
That's right.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Kenneth Ackerman, and he is the author of a newly published biography of Boss Tweed. And that's the title, The Rise and Fall of the Corrupt Paul Who Conceived the Soul of Modern New York. That's the subtitle. And the publisher of the book is Carolyn Graff. And if you're interested in reading about Boss Tweed, you can head out to the bookstore and look for the book. And here on the program, also questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line if you're listening in and around Illinois, Indiana. Or if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. We do have a caller on the toll-free and someone listening this morning in Indiana. We'll go there. Line four. Hello.
Oh, yes. I have two questions. One is a little bit off base, but I'm hoping you can give them some enlightenment. Ever since I've been in high school and learned about it, I wondered how in the hell it happened. And I'm talking about the $300 that you could pay to not go into the war. I was wondering if you happen to know what combinations in Congress and where Lincoln was and all this is something that on its face value it seems, you know, senseless. You know, you expect them to expect the poor to, in a sense, rise up in some sense. So I wonder if you know anything about that in relationship to Tweed. And the second question has to do with Thomas Nast. Was he ever under any danger at all by doing his political cartoons? And thanks a lot.
Okay.
Two good questions. Well, let me start with the $300, because that's a curious one. It was part of the draft law enacted by Congress in 1863. It was actually very controversial in Congress. Lincoln didn't really take a stand on it. He didn't like it, but he didn't fight it. It was put in by Republican members of Congress, primarily for the reasons you would think. They were generally wealthier people. At least one of them, James G. Blaine of Maine, later a presidential contender, paid the $300 to get out of going to the Army in order to serve in Congress. Another congressman at the time, James Garfield, a future president who had served in combat early in the war, argued very strongly against it on the House floor. But it was passed on a divided vote in the House and Senate, became part of the law. And even after the draft riots, there was a movement a year later, I believe, in 1864, to repeal that $300 commutation clause, and Congress refused to do it. There was so much backing among wealthier people to keep it in place that it lasted throughout the war. As far as Thomas Nast goes, Nast was a central player in the whole Tweed story. Nast became nationally famous during the Civil War as an illustrator. These new illustrated journals were a new phenomenon in America. They had just started in the 1850s. The whole idea of being able to get images of people and events mass-produced immediately and circulated all around town was a very new thing. So they were very popular. And Nast was the most original, edgy artist of his time who used this for politics. He took on Tweed and basically turned him into a laughing stock. He turned him into a cartoon character, a fat, kind of ugly-looking, with a big nose, a silly grin, always walking, always looking fat with a big diamond stick pin on his chest. When Nast got going, there was harassment against Harper's Weekly, the journal that published him, as well as harassment against the New York Times. It took mostly financial form. The city of New York, for instance, refused to buy textbooks from the Harper Publishing Company, which published Nast's cartoons as a way of getting them to drop out of, to give up the fight, but they refused to do it. Whether he was under physical danger, he says he was. It's very unclear whether he was.
One of the quotes that I come across that has been attributed to Tweed, and I don't know if he in fact actually said it, but he was obviously very unhappy of these caricatures that Nast was producing. He didn't like it, and he is said to have said something like, "I don't care what the papers say about me. My constituents can't read, but damn it, they can see the pictures."
Well, it's interesting. There are a couple of quotes like that that are attributed to Tweed, very famous quotations that he very likely never said.
Hmm.
That quote that you mentioned appeared in Harper's Weekly at the height of the Tweed battle, was repeated over and over and over again. There's no direct sourcing on it. It's not even in quotation marks when it was first used in Harper's. Another one like that is, what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly Tweed was confronted with the charges of financial corruption and shouted at a reporter, what are you going to do about it? That quote first appeared in a Thomas Nast cartoon. It was repeated over and over and over. It was used against Tweed constantly in the fight, but there's no evidence that he ever said it.
We should talk a little bit about Tammany Hall, as if there certainly have been over time political bosses in big American cities, figures like Tweed. But Tweed is the one, if there's any name that's going to get a flicker of recognition from people, it's him. And associated with Tweed will be Tammany Hall, which is something that was in existence before he kind of came along and became the boss. He didn't invent mm-hmm. this. What was Tammany Hall?
Well, Tammany Hall it started out as a social club around the time of the Revolutionary War, one of the patriotic clubs where people would get together, have a few drinks, and socialize. It became political very early on, though. Aaron Burr was the first person to use it as a political machine, and over time it became stronger and stronger. In the 1840s, it decided to cast its fate with working men. It developed an alliance with the Irish immigrant community. It worked for universal manhood suffrage, which was a very new idea in the 1840s. It threw in its support to Andrew Jackson and the common man. At the time, there was no formal office that would say Democratic Party New York City. Instead, you had a couple of competing political clubs, each trying to gain recognition as the official voice of the Democratic Party in New York. And Tammany Hall was the biggest one of these. It competed against a couple of others. And Tweed became the head of it. When Tweed took over, he basically eclipsed all the others. He made Tammany so strong with its tie to the immigrant community in particular that no one else could compete with it.
And
Tammany remained a power for 90 years after him.
Let's take another call here. We have someone listening in Eureka this morning. This is also on the toll-free line, line 4. Hello?
Good morning. I'd just like to check out a quote and its possible accuracy. I believe it was Garrison Keillor in one of his writer's almanac. I quoted something like the following statement to Boss Tweed, an honest politician, when bought, stays bought. Does that have the ring of truth?
It's the kind of thing he would say, but I've never seen him. I've never seen that quoted from him.
I see. Okay.
Tweed was actually very careful about his public statements because he knew he was being watched. He was a public figure who was often investigated, especially once the New York Times and Harper's Weekly started campaigning against him. He had to watch his words very carefully.
Mm-hmm. Of course, he could have said it in private, and it got publicly quoted or something. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Boss Tweed, William Tweed, held a number of political offices. He was an alderman. He was elected to the Congress. He was in the House. He was in the New York State Senate. But it seems that his where he would rather be was more behind the scenes, and felt that that being in that position was everything, gave him all the power he needed, gave him the opportunity to enrich himself and his cronies. And in fact, someone might have suggested to him maybe he'd like to run for mayor, and he would have said, "Why? What would be the point? Why do I need to be the mayor? I'm running the city now."
He basically controlled mayors. By running Tammany Hall, he controlled the election apparatus. He could pick who would be nominated, and his nominees always won. As a result, the governor owed his job to Tweed. The mayor owed his job to Tweed. He controlled the state legislature, both through his own role as chairman of a major committee in the state Senate, plus controlling the appointments. The one official job that did give him power was he was the director of public works in New York City. And as a result, he directly controlled all of the hundreds of patronage jobs for the people who did manual labor, paving the streets and digging the sewers and working in the parks. And that was a very early power base for him. But mostly, as you say, he worked behind the scenes.
Yeah. The way that he made his money, essentially, he and his associates made his money, it touches on the fact that he and the people in his circle essentially had control over all of the official business of the city, all of the contracting, and that they worked out a scheme where essentially people overpaid. The city overpaid for just about everything, and that then the people who got the contract, whether this was for paving or for providing printing services or for building a building, then would kick back the extra, the overhead would go then back to Tweed and his people who set up the deal in the first place. And that was how it is that he and his circle managed to make so much money, managed to skim so much money, that kind of figure that we talked about earlier, over this relatively short period of time. How exactly did that work?
Well, it was an old game, and Tweed took it and expanded it drove it to its limit. Basically, if you were a contractor doing any work for the city, either providing services or providing goods, in order to get your bills paid, you had to submit it to the County Board of Supervisors. At the time, the New York City and New York County were basically the same. New York was Manhattan Island. The boroughs weren't added until later. A little bit like Cook County and Chicago. The two were the same. The supervisors then would insist that you inflate your bill by it started out at 15%. And that extra money would be kicked back to Tweed and one or two other members who would make sure that only their friends' bills got paid, or only the contractors who paid the kickback got paid. Over time, as he became more powerful, that 15% rose to 25 and 35. Ultimately, it reached 65% at its height. Over the 3 or 4 year period when Tweed and his group were in total control of New York, the city debt rose from about $30 million to almost $100 million. From a combination of graft, as well as the actual cost of servicing the city, spending lavishly on city improvements, patronage jobs, paving streets, and so on, Tweed made a point to keep taxes low so that the wealthy would support him, even while all of this was going on. But the cost of all of this spending was passed either to investors on Wall Street or to bondholders in Europe. And so the hope was that the piper would never have to be paid.
Yeah. I was really struck by something that I read. I think it was actually in one of the reviews of the book, talking about just how big the city was, how big the city of New York was, how big its budget was, what an enormous financial entity it was, that the budget for the city of New York, I think if I remember this right, the budget for the city of New York was bigger than the budget for all of the states along the Atlantic coast, including New York State, all put together?
That sounds right. And when you think of it, New York City was by far the biggest city in America. And the functions of state government and even national government were very limited at the time. The federal treasury was, I believe, under $100 million at that time. It exploded during the Civil War, but once peace returned, the cost of the federal government was basically limited to a few small bureaus. The Treasury Department, which ran the customs houses, was the biggest department, not counting the army on the frontier. So New York was very large. It had about 1 million people at that time, mostly crowded into the lower half of Manhattan Island. What's striking is that for such a big city and such a big budget, the controls were so loose. The fact that Tweed and his cronies were able to take really total control of the city treasury with very little oversight, there was no normal accounting. They went to, they were supposed to issue an annual statement of the city debt, and at one point they just stopped, and no one could do anything about it.
Let's talk with another listener here, someone in Effingham on a cell phone, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm on the cell, so I just had 3 quick questions. I'll hang up and listen. From what little I know, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the beginning of Boss Tweed's demise came with the building of the City Hall, I think, which ran so far over budget that it actually cost more to build than the White House. Now, that's what I've heard. I don't know. You might want to expound on that. And I just was wondering, as far as his actual demise, how did he die? You know, what state was he in financially? And what year, in fact, did he pass away? And if you guys want to comment on that, thank you.
Okay. Well, that's sort of the second half of the story that we haven't quite gotten to yet, and we will. Do you want to talk about the City Hall project?
Okay. The building that Tweed was associated with that finally brought him down was, it wasn't the City Hall itself, it was the county courthouse. Tweed had been, during his period, New York City was building a new county courthouse that would house, that would centralize all of the court buildings and all of the city and county offices that didn't fit in City Hall. It was a very large building, and it stands today in City Hall Park in New York. It's called the Tweed Courthouse. It's a gorgeous building. It has a central octagonal rotunda with stained glass ceilings and beautiful geometric arches, internal columns. But it went way over budget. And what happened was that one of the disgruntled people within Tweed's own organization, the county sheriff, who was very jealous of money that other people were making, managed to get his hands on some copied account books from the city controller's office, and after a long period of indecision, he tried to blackmail Tweed with these account books. Finally, he decided to be a good citizen, and he gave them to the New York Times, which printed them. These are the so-called secret account disclosures, the first time anything like this had been exposed by any newspaper in America. And what they showed were expenses on the courthouse which were so impossibly large that you knew they had to be fraudulent. For instance, the amount of money supposedly spent for chairs for the courthouse was enough to purchase 314,000 chairs, which if you put them in a line would make a line 17 miles long. There was enough money put aside or supposedly spent on carpets for the courthouse that if you made a strip 1 foot wide, it would go from lower Manhattan all the way to New Haven, Connecticut. The New York Times laid all of this information out with that kind of detail, and that was what ultimately brought about Tweed's downfall. Samuel Tilden, a lawyer in New York, figured out a way to trace this overspending, this obvious graft, from the city treasury ultimately directly to Boss Tweed's account at the Broadway Bank. And that was what caused the ultimate indictments and prosecutions that put him in jail. Tweed died in New York City, in jail, the jail on Ludlow Street, the very famous jail. It was a debtor's prison. Many well-known people served time there. It was joked that Tweed was the head of the Board of Supervisors when the Ludlow Street jail was being built. If he knew he was going to be spending so much time there, they would have made it a nicer place. But he died a broken man. He knew he would never get out of jail. He had tried to escape at one point. He had spent a lot of money on bribes and managed to slip away, get as far as Cuba and then Spain, but was rearrested and brought back to New York to serve his time. He made a full confession of his crimes late in life, as part of a deal with prosecutors in exchange for release, but the deal was broken. They refused to release him. By the time he died in jail, it was 1878. He was 55 years old. He was a broken man. He was in failing health. His family had largely deserted him because of the scandal. The harassment against his family by the media was merciless. His wife was traveling in Europe. Under an assumed name. She called herself Mrs. Weed. so that she wouldn't be confused with her husband. He had two sons who were kept in a boarding school in New England, not even told of their father's death. He had one daughter who stayed in New York City and was loyal to him to the end, but she was really the only one close by. There was no Tweed fortune at that point. Most of the money had dissipated away, either in lawyer bills or in forced sales or in money that he tried to get to his children, but they were forced to sell off to pay bills.
You know, given his association with political corruption in the city, it's surprising that someone along the line, or maybe someone did, suggest that maybe the Tweed Courthouse should be renamed.
Well, this is part of the irony of Boss Tweed. On the one hand, he is easily the most corrupt politician to ever serve in America, and was convicted on 204 counts of misdemeanor fraud and died a disgraced man in jail. But today, 130 years later, he is honored by the city by having his name on the courthouse, on the Tweed Courthouse, because he was so popular and because people feel he did so many good things during his life.
Very quickly, let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Kenneth Ackerman. He's written several books about the Gilded Age and now has produced this new book. It's a biography of Boss Tweed, and it's published by Carroll and Graff. It's out now. If you're interested in reading it, you can go down to the bookstore and look at the book. And if you'd like to call in here, ask a question, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, supposing that we could again bring Boss Tweed back and allow the man to speak in his own defense about all of the things that he would have said that he did good for the city of New York and the people of New York. How would he make the case for himself?
Well, if Boss Tweed were to come back, he would probably point out the fact that while recognizing the bad things he did, he and his circle really did more to build New York City and to bring the immigrants and the poor into the political mainstream than anyone else during that era. Tweed has his fingerprints on really every major New York institution from the late 1800s, from the Brooklyn Bridge to the New York Stock Exchange to the Metropolitan Museum of Art to the Museum of Natural History to Mount Sinai's Hospital. The list goes on and on. It was his group that spent the money to pave the streets around Midtown, to widen Broadway, to dig sewers all over town, to build the infrastructure to allow the city to expand northward. He made a point. He had a very pragmatic tie with the immigrant community, but the effect of it was to bring the Irish and the Germans and several others into politics, into society at a time when nativism, when prejudice against immigrants was at its height. But Tweed Tweed felt it important to take on that fight. So there is good that went with the bad, and Tweed was appreciated during his lifetime. When even after the attacks on him for corruption had been going on for almost a full year, most people in New York either didn't believe it or didn't want to believe it or refused to believe it. When he would throw a political rally, he could draw tens of thousands of people. There was one where the crowd was estimated at between 40 and 100,000 people who came out primarily to see Boss Tweed. They would come marching in matching red shirts, which was a homage to Tweed's background on the New York Fire Department, marching in formation. Political rallies back then were a whole level beyond what we have today. Torchlight parades and fireworks and brass bands, a whole level of showmanship. But he was very, very popular.
Right. Well, I'm sure that it was a major form of entertainment at the time. The political rally was.
Mm-hmm. It was before TV and movies, so it was the national soap opera.
Let's take another caller here. Someone listening in Chicago, line four.
Yeah,
hello.
Hi. By the way, they just finished, I think, the renovation of the Tweed Courthouse in New York within the last year. Spent a few million dollars to do it. With respect to Tweed and the corruption, I don't think he could have existed without the cooperation his working hand in glove with those of the leaders of the Republican Party. This was the days in which the robber barons took control of the Republican Party locally and nationally. Early on, the Republican Party was a mixture of these robber barons who, I guess, supplied the money with the abolitionists who eventually remained within the party but were relatively powerless in much of the country. These guys, the robber barons who were operating in New York, involved Astor, who built many of the slums in the Lower East Side and in the Tenderloin District, just to the west of Times Square, 40th Street, 30th Street, and so on, 20th Street. The Vanderbilts, the New York Central Railroad, the guy who controlled the Erie and Lackawanna railroads. There was lots of money passed during those days to gain control of these businesses, and also Wall Street. Do you have anything to say about the Republican Party then and the money that passed between them?
Mm-hmm. The caller is absolutely right on this. Tweed had several close ties with the Republican Party and with the robber barons. They did work hand in glove. He was particularly close with Jay Gould, who was the head of the Erie Railroad, and his partner Jim Fisk. When Jay Gould and Fisk cornered the gold market, for instance, in 1869, or tried to corner the gold market, Tweed was right in the middle of it working with them. He also represented Cornelius Vanderbilt, Commodore Vanderbilt, in the New York State Legislature when Vanderbilt tried to get some laws changed on one of his stock manipulations. Tweed was the one who he turned to. Tweed's machine always made a point to take a limited number of well-known Republicans and put them in high-profile positions to give the illusion of bipartisanship. For instance, there was a Republican named Henry Smith who ran the police board while Tweed was the boss. But Henry Smith would always do a favor for Tweed if Tweed asked him for one. Chester Allen Arthur, a future Republican president of the United States and a Republican boss in his own right, was relatively young during this period, but he had a job as a counsel for a tax commission under Tweed's regime. So he, too, was a Tweed Republican. At one point, when Tweed was being accused of manipulating the city books, he and his controller, Richard Connolly, put together a six-member commission headed by John Jacob Astor III, one of the wealthiest men in New York, who gave their blessing to the city books. So he always had those kinds of ties. And the reason was that Tweed's regime was a good deal for the wealthy. During his time in power, he spent a lot of money on city improvements. And even though a lot of that money went into corruption and graft and was wasted, still, property values were up all over town. It was a period very much like the 1990s. The economy was good. The economy was working. And while the causes were much larger than Boss Tweed, he was certainly part of the environment that made it work. As far as the courthouse and its renovation, it's interesting. The renovation was completed just recently. It originally was going to go for be used as a city museum, but Mayor Bloomberg decided to put the Board of Education in the Tweed Courthouse, which caused quite a few wry remarks in the New York press. At one point, they were going to start a day school for the children of people who worked there and call it the Tweed Academy, until a couple of historians complained and started joking about what would you teach in the Tweed Academy.
Let's go on here. We have a caller in Urbana on line number one. We'll talk with them next. Hello.
Yeah, good morning, Ken. I would like, if you could, give us a criticism of the film Gangs of New York. I think most Americans know about this as a result of Scorsese's film. It's got its good side and its bad side, but I'm really interested in your critique of it to sort of straighten the record out. And what the specific gravity of the International Working Men's Association was in New York at this time. That is to say, Karl Marx's First International, of which Frederick Douglass was a member. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thanks for the question. Gangs of New York is a very interesting movie. Probably the most ironic point is that if you pick up a copy of the book by Herbert Asbury, the name Boss Tweed doesn't appear anywhere in the book. He's not even mentioned in the book. However, in making the movie, Martin Scorsese, the producer, had to create certain composite characters in order to tell the story. And it was really impossible to tell a story about New York during that era without including Boss Tweed. Now, you can nitpick that movie to death, and it's very easy to do. A lot of people have done it. The Bill the Butcher character was based on a man named Bill Poole, who was a fighter, a saloon gambler, and a nativist, who died actually before the Civil War. The character in the movie was based partly on him, but partly also on another figure named Isaiah Reinders, who was a political figure in the 7th Ward, actually a rival of Tweed early on in Tweed's career. That the level of violence that they showed in the movie was very characteristic of New York, more in the 1820s and 1830s. By the time you got to the 50s and 60s, the way politics was manipulated was more by ballot box stuffing and intimidation rather than outright murder or killing. The one thing that I guess I didn't like about the movie, I saw it at the time that I was starting to work on this book, was the way that Tweed was portrayed. They made him look very sleazy in a way, that he was a double talker, that he was someone who would play second fiddle to Bill the Butcher. And my feeling was that Tweed would not play second fiddle to anyone. And if you saw him walking down the street, he would not look comical. He would look friendly, outgoing, interesting, interested. But he was someone that you would take seriously. He's someone that you could do business with.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Ken Ackerman. He's the author of a new biography of Boss Tweed. It's just out now. You can look for it in the bookstore. We have maybe about 10 minutes left, and certainly if there are other people listening who have questions, you may call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess one of the things that strikes me is the continuing popularity among writers particularly, and I guess particularly I think of novelists, of the Gilded Age New York. And I suppose the more I read about it, the more engaging and the more remarkable it is that you can find almost any story there, or you could set almost any mm-hmm. story there. And then that when you look at the truth and what life was really like at the time, some of it seems almost too much. You think, no, you couldn't really make up a story like that. And yet you can find real life stories. It must have been at the time the most booming place, certainly the most booming place in America, maybe the one of the most ethnically diverse, one of the biggest spreads between the rich and the poor. It must have been quite a place.
It was a fascinating city to live in at the time. It was a tough city to live in at the time. We tend to forget today just how hard life was for people 130 years ago with. Well, basics: no bathrooms, no showers, no food standards. The streets were mostly muddy and crowded. Traffic was snarled to a level that we couldn't even imagine today. If you picture a major city like Broadway with no traffic lights, no cars, but just a swarm of horses and carriages and people. In the streets with no order or direction, and narrow crooked streets that it was impossible to get across. But in that cauldron of humanity, there was a certain vitality and dynamism and energy, partly because people who lived in New York had come there for a reason. The immigrants in New York were mostly first generation. They were people who were either born in Europe, Ireland, Germany, England, a dozen other countries, and had made the crossing themselves, or their parents had made it within recent memory. Tweed estimated at one point that something like 60% of the vote in New York in the 1860s was foreign-born, were immigrants. So that number. And at the same time, you had a city that had just gone, or a country that had just gone through the shock of civil war, the changes of industrialization, an enormous influx of money, because the American economy was going through an enormous boom, and all of the money around the country from telegraphs, railroads, agriculture was all flowing to New York, the largest port and the home of the New York Stock Exchange. And with so few rules and bureaucracy and limitations, it was a very freewheeling place. These social forces were played out in very dramatic, very direct ways. There was no other way for things to happen except very directly. So it made for an interesting place.
Yeah. Let's see if we can get at least one more caller here. We'll go to line one in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, I enjoyed, I'm calling on a cell phone, and I certainly enjoy your show, and I wish I could have called in on yesterday's, but today is very interesting. Follow-up question on the caller relating to the Gangs of New York movie, mm-hmm. But my question is, what was Tweed's position on the Civil War? Where what was his that didn't come out in the movie, whether he was pro and this not necessarily the slavery question, because it was really an issue over states' rights, but it didn't come out whether he was for the draft, and if I remember my history, that draft riot actually did occur. I don't remember in history, U.S. and Pennsylvania history, but I don't recall we weren't taught details. More or less, a draft riot occurred. I think, if I remember right, that's all.
Well, the draft riot did occur, and it was an epic level riot. Well over 100 people were killed. Thousands of people were injured. Millions of dollars of property damage was done. As far as Tweed's position on the Civil War, he was a war Democrat, which was not a small thing to be at the time. New York City was a very disloyal city. It was there were more copperheads, anti-Lincoln, anti-war Democrats in New York than any other northern city. Early in the war, the mayor, a man named Fernando Wood, had half seriously proposed that New York should secede from the Union itself and become a free city dealing with both the North and the South. There was that kind of sentiment. But Tammany Hall, in particular, stuck with the Union. It was a loyal group, which gave it credibility on all sides. It was close to the immigrants and to the immigrant community because of the services it provided, but it was credible with Republicans because it was loyal in the war. It actually raised a troop of soldiers for the Union Army, which was headed originally by a man named William Kennedy, who was the Grand Sachem of Tammany Hall. If you go to the Gettysburg National Park, the Gettysburg Battlefield, you'll see a statue of an Indian. And what it is a monument to the Tammany Hall Brigade that fought at Gettysburg. So Tweed was a war Democrat, but more than that, he was a pragmatist. And he recognized that if Tammany was going to be influential after the war, that it had to show its loyalty during the war. And he was very helpful to Lincoln and to Edwin Stanton, his Secretary of War, in settling the draft issue and being the head of the recruitment committee in New York City during the war.
Certainly it helped their pursuit of Tweed helped establish a number of people, among them Samuel Tilden, who mm-hmm. went on to run for president. In fact, I guess some people think he actually won, but he wasn't the president. In what way were the people who were part of this group who were going after Tweed, in what way were they made by the effort to bring him down and by bringing him down?
Well, quite a few people, as you say, when Tweed went down with such a crash and with such a scandal, the people who brought him down were very well rewarded. Samuel Tilden, the lawyer who put together the legal case against Tweed and aided the prosecution, became so famous as a result of it that he rode that fame first to become governor of New York. As governor, he took on the upstate canal ring, and between those two things, he became known as the most important crime fighter of his generation. That was the basis on which he launched his presidential bid in 1876. He did win the popular vote against Rutherford Hayes, but there was a dispute about the electoral vote in three southern states, very similar to the George Bush-Al Gore election of 2000. It was a disputed outcome. A special commission was chosen to sort it out, and they voted on a party line vote to give all the disputed votes to Hayes. There, it's widely felt that Tilden was cheated out of that election. The others who became very famous as a result were Thomas Nast of Harper's Weekly, and then also the publisher of the New York Times, George Jones. The New York Times playing the crucial role in actually breaking the case against Tweed. A number of smaller players, several prosecutors went on to seats in the United States Congress. The judge who put Tweed in jail became the chief judge of New York. But several reformers made their name on that case.
Well, we're going to have to stop because we're at the end of the time. But if you'd like to read more of the story, look for the book that we have mentioned. It's titled Boss Tweed, The Rise and Fall of the Corrupt Paul Who Conceived the Soul of Modern New York. And the publisher on the book is Carolyn Graff, by our guest Kenneth Ackerman. And Mr. Ackerman, thanks very much.
David, thank you. I enjoyed very much.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives, a show we first presented on June 8th. Many other programs from Focus are there, as well as interviews from the Afternoon Magazine, all of our local production. It's at wyll.uiuc.edu. Programs here on AM 580 made possible by grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. That's for it for us here on Focus 580, but we want you to stay tuned. There's much more in the way of news, features, weather, other sorts of things coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll feature an interview from the archives. We'll rebroadcast our interview with Vicki Croak, author of The Lady and the Panda, The True Adventures of the First American Explorer to Bring Back China's Most Exotic Animal. That follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look now at the Chicago Board of Trade, where prices are higher. September wheat, 322.5, up 2.5. December, 337.25, up 1.25. September corn, 223.25, up 2.75. December, 236.75, up 2.25.